Hey, deep fried fans. Have you ever had fried oysters? Try frying some up and dipping them in a cocktail sauce with a little dash of Tabasco. It's delicious. This is Ellie Mae here to announce show number 23, recorded live at the Professional Developer Conference in October of 2008. In this episode, Keith and Woody sit down with Oliver Sturm. Oliver is an experienced software architect, developer, trainer, author, and a language enthusiast. Oliver says that he thinks he's a nice guy, but he's prepared to accept other opinions on that matter. He's a C# MVP, and he works for Developer Express as a technical evangelist and lead program manager for the Frameworks Division. In this episode, Oliver discusses functional programming in C#. Okay, deep fried fans, grab that glass of sweet tea and get ready for some Gumpology.
Hey, folks, welcome to another episode of Deep Fried Bite.
What's up, Brother Elder?
Oh, I'm doing good, man. We're sitting live at the floor of PDC 2008, and we're recording live from the Expo show. You'll hear a little bit of background noise in the background, but we're going to try to clean that up as much as we can.
Well, but you know what? It just shows how much love and like joy and happiness. I'm kind of hippie right now, but
that's awesome.
But no, we're having lots of fun out here at PDC, so for anybody who didn't make it this year, come to the next one.
That's right. And we've got a huge crowd around the table. We've probably got about 30 or 40 people listening live to the show. It's really, really cool. So, but, you know, right now we're sitting down with a handsome gentleman. Didn't want one of our good friends, Mark Miller, to be cursed with having the only bald head, so he shaved his too. And his name is Oliver Sturm. Oliver, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Oliver.
Good
so
to
we
be
got,
here.
We've got a lot of accents in this. So we got a little Midwestern accent, a little Southern, and
we were talking about this before the show. And tell us a little bit about yourself. And he had a funny thing about different nationalities. He can kind of explain.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's that funny, really. You know, it's me, right, that you're talking about. But yeah, I'm originally German, but I live in Scotland, and I used to live in London before. And of course, I work for a U.S. company, so the accent that I have is totally confusing. And you know, American people typically hear some sort of English influence in my accent, whereas English people just think I'm from some place they've never been to because it just confuses them to no end.
You're really German, huh?
Yep, I am.
Were you born in Germany?
I was. Okay, well, I've actually lived there up until about 6 years ago, so it's not that long.
Okay.
Yep.
And where do you live now?
I live in Scotland, in, or close to a little town called Hawick, which is in the Scottish Borders. It's about 50 miles south of Edinburgh.
How big is the town?
15,000 people, I think, something like
nice
that.
Nice little quaint little town, rolling,
you know,
rolling
it's
hills.
It's big enough to have some supermarkets and post office and that sort of stuff there, but nothing else.
Do you get
the
internet there?
I get internet there,
nice.
Yes. Well, I'm actually on a farm outside the town, you know, but still, yep.
We have a lot in common then. I live on outside of town. I could have a farm if I
cool.
wanted one.
Yeah.
You have a book coming out, right?
That is right, yes. Well, I'm actually in the process of writing it, so, but after I've written it, it'll come out, I'm promised. So, yeah, it's on functional programming in C#.
Is that the name of it?
That is also the name of it, yes.
Okay.
It
now,
is.
I have to admit on record that he told me about the book name a while ago, and I'm like, knowing his personality, he's always kidding around, right? And I'm like, okay, seriously, what's the name of the book? He's like, no, it's functional programming in C#, and my jaw at the floor, and I'm like, okay, we got to talk now, right? So, all right, so Oliver, give us, what are you writing? I mean, what's going to be in this book? I mean, this is kind of a crazy thing you're doing, like functional programming in C#. This is going to change the world as we know it, I think.
Maybe it will. You never know. Well, you know, one of the main reasons why people look at functional programming these days is the scalability thing, right? Everybody wants to create applications that run well on those multi-core processors that everybody has. And in order to do that, using functional approaches is one thing you can do to solve that scalability, that threading problem that everybody has. And, or, well, you know, that locking problem is probably closer to what I should say, really. Now, for a lot of people, using functional approaches means using a language that is targeted specifically at programming in a functional way. And, of course, Microsoft F# goes that way, and there are other languages, more traditional languages, that could be used to do that same thing. But for a lot of people, the step over to F sharp, however easy it is, will still not be, you know, the approach of choice, because they've got a large team to think of. They might have a huge code base that they need to take care of. They can't get the developers, for a start, who can actually write code in F sharp. And so they need to be able to use those approaches in languages that they already use, like C sharp. And that's the idea. So the content of my book is really about how to use these approaches. There are certain things that functional people know, like, you know, currying, just to mention one example, is a technique of changing the format of call parameters, if you will, into functions. You can do that in C sharp, only it's not automatic like it's in F sharp, or you know, supported by library functionality as it is in other languages. You have to do some steps yourself to make that sort of thing work. And my book will tell you how.
So are you going to be hitting C Sharp 3.0, or is this going to be a book against C Sharp 4?
No, this is C Sharp 3, yes.
So we can use it today?
We can use it today. Yep. Actually, C Sharp 3, it has that support for Lambda expressions that a lot of people associate with doing functional programming. But then again, Lambda expressions are only a different syntax, really, for anonymous methods that we've already had since C-Sharp 2. So in reality, there isn't a lot of really important functionality as such in C-Sharp 3. But part of the problem you have if you use a language that is not inherently functional to do functional things in, part of the problem you have that is that the syntax is not going to be as concise as if you did the same thing, say, in F-sharp. And so Lambda expressions are an important part to make that work, you know, to the extent that the code you write is not going to be, you know, too verbose, really, to be practical any longer. So, yeah, but again, you could go back to .NET 2, really, to C-sharp 2, if you're just looking at the functionality itself.
So being that you're a C-sharp MVP, mm-hmm. and we're here at PDC, and they have a lot of new announcements about C-sharp 4, what's your take on C-sharp 4.0? Are you excited about it?
Yes, I am excited about it. It has some very interesting things with regard to dynamic language integration. Well, not integration, perhaps, but, you know, interoperability with dynamic languages, which, of course, is very important. A new strategic platform for Microsoft, really, in with Silverlight being available right now with those integrated languages that run on the DLR and so on. So that's really a major step they're making in C-Sharp 4 to make that easier to use from C-Sharp, or the other way around, of course, if you write applications in Iron Python or Iron Ruby or something, going back to C sharp is also going to be somewhat easier to do. So from that perspective, yeah. They could have done a little more functional stuff in there, if you ask me, but of course everybody has got their pet things, I think, that they are waiting for, and C sharp is traditionally a C-based language, so a lot of people are really opposed to extending it into directions that are, you know, slightly different from what a C-based language has always been in the past. So,
what do you think about them getting rid of all of, like, the overrides and changing that stuff up too in the language?
Yeah, I'm not sure, to be honest. But you know, to really understand how these things are going to pan out, we would probably have to wait a little longer than PDC, first of all, because these things aren't finalized yet. And second, it'll take a little more time to understand how these things fit into the architecture of existing code. You know, if you've used a particular approach to using inheritance, for instance, or a composition to design your class hierarchies, then you might have to rethink these things to an extent to make them work with new language features or with the absence of existing ones, however, whichever way it goes, really.
Okay, Oliver, so, you know, it's hard to write code on a podcast, but we'll do the best we can. Go back to, you know, functional programming with C-sharp. I mean, give us, you know, like a Hello World example, or, I mean, can you give us something as to what you're putting out, what you're thinking, and what it's going to look like, you know?
That's a little hard to do with regard to those advanced techniques like I was mentioning currying before, right? But I can try to explain currying if you want me to do that. for instance. That's kind of cool. I mean, the idea of currying basically is that you have a function, or you start out with a function that takes a number of parameters. Say I've got like an add function, which has two parameters, x and y, and the result, of course, is an addition of those two. Applying currying to that function means that you convert it into a chain of functions, where the first one takes only the first parameter, the x, for instance, and returns another function that then in turn takes the second parameter and performs the original calculation. And the reason why both of those values are then available to do the calculation work, actually, is that we are using closures, or the compiler uses closures automatically to store these values away inside the lambda, if you will. You know, it's a little hard to put that in words, really, what's going on there. Well, as a result, as I said, we've got one function that takes one parameter, returns another function, as opposed to taking both parameters at the same time. And the reason why that is a good idea, and one of the basics, really, of functional programming, is because you can now go and call this function while only passing in some of the parameters. So in this example, I could only pass in one, for instance, one parameter, that is. So say I've got this you know, very generic function add, which can basically add anything. It can add one arbitrary parameter to one other arbitrary parameter. Say your application has need of an add function, but you actually always need to add five, right? Your adding doesn't really need two parameters. It only needs one, because one of them is always five. Then you could now go and create a new add function, so to speak, by passing in that five as the first parameter, and you get back a new function, right? And that new function is sort of pre-configured to always do that thing, that slightly more specific thing, that adding five thing, right? So that process is called function construction, and it's one of the underlying things, really, in functional programming. What it means to us as imperative programmers is that we are now able to create functions on a new level that we weren't able to create functions on previously. Because, you know, if you refactor, for instance, Your traditional way in an object-oriented language of extracting a method is to create that method on the class level, right? It sits next to the method you were currently working on. But that is not really quite the right place for that new method, I think. You know, look at agile programming. They say you take the use case, you do precisely what is required to fulfill the requirements, and you don't do anything else, right? So does that include creating new functions on the class level that are really only referred to by one other function? I don't think so. And this functional approach allows you to use and reuse functions within other functions as building blocks, basically, where previously you only had classes and methods in classes as building blocks, and now you have this additional level that you can use to build new things out of. And I think that's an extremely interesting approach, regardless really of the language that you're talking about.
Okay, folks, so here's what we just did. We just basically said, okay, Oliver,
we
got to get our heads around this thing. So what we just did, folks, sitting here at the table, I had my notebook here, and I didn't actually have Visual Studio, but I had OneNote. I'm like, Oliver, just type in some of this code so we can see what you're talking about on this currying thing. And so he typed it out, and we're sitting here looking at it, and we're still looking at it. I got to get my head around it.
I think I get it, but I don't think I could. I get it enough to understand, but I don't think I get it enough to ever do it inside my own.
Yeah, like I would have never thought to do it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take this code sample, and we're going to put it up on the blog post. So if you're listening, hopefully you're not driving to work.
Yeah, because this is where you have to be in front of your computer
so we want you
right
to
now.
Go
so.
To the website, go to deepfriedbytes.com and click on the podcast with Oliver look at this code sample. So we're going to have Oliver just walk us through this code sample so we can all kind of get our heads around it. We're going to polish this up a little bit. You're going to send us like a real version of it, so we'll talk about it, right?
Yeah.
So we'll have syntax highlighting some comments around it. So, all right, so starting at line number one, what are we looking at here?
We're looking at a lambda expression, basically, that takes two parameters, x and y, you know, that sample that I was just talking about a moment earlier, and returns x plus y. So basically, I've got a function by the name of add that can add x and y. And I could now call this function as well by just passing in parameters to that add thing, right? So even though I haven't created a method in the object-oriented sense of the word, I've still created a function, which is an element that lives inside another function.
Okay, that's interesting.
Okay, we get that.
Okay.
I get that. So I'm smart enough to get that. So let's go on.
So, I mean, basically, without lambdas, mm-hmm. we couldn't really do this stuff with a functional programming, basically.
No, you could do that without lambdas, because basically the anonymous functions in C# 2 have exactly the same functionality. It would just look more verbose.
You're right, yeah, okay.
But without that type of functionality of anonymous functions with any sort of syntax, no, you couldn't, well, you could probably still use certain approaches of functional programming, but being able to treat a function as a sort of data element that you can store away in a variable and pass around and so on, that is really one of the pillars of functional programming that is very important.
Okay, so that's the first example then, right? So that's mm-hmm. sort of that's the building block that we're going to start with. Okay,
right.
So now let's go to the second thing you did here.
So the second one is a curried version, so to speak, of that same function. And to begin with, I've used anonymous methods to make it clearer what the hierarchy of the thing really is. So basically, my new function takes an integer parameter, and it returns another function that takes an integer parameter and in turn returns an int, right? Because the result of my overall calculation is going to be an int when I work with ints and add them up. So, and what I do is I use this delegate block, so an anonymous method, C# 2 syntax, basically. I get the first value x as a parameter, and I return another delegate that takes the y as a parameter, and then returns x plus y. And I use this format first because it's easier to see why basically the x and the y are available at the nested point to do that addition operation, right? It's a little harder to believe in the lambda form that I'm going to get to next. So in this case, it's quite easy to believe because you see the nesting and you can see what is inside the other thing, so to speak. What happens, of course, is that the compiler basically notices the x parameter in the outer delegate is being used in the expression that is being returned. And so normally the x parameter would run out of scope, right? If you just leave the function, there isn't any x anymore. But if you start passing other functions around and you want to be able to call those functions from other places in your code, then, of course, if the x just dropped off the stack or whatever, your application would basically crash, right? So you don't want that to happen. And so the compiler goes and says, okay, we need that x later on, so I'm going to keep it around. And that process of keeping it around is called, you know, loosely storing it inside a closure. So that's what's happening there. The closure is the data unit, if you will, that just keeps that parameter available for later access. And so, that's what's going on there. I've suddenly got a chain of functions, each of which takes one parameter as opposed to one single function that takes several parameters. And that chain, of course, could be much, much longer. It doesn't have to be just two parameters. It could be as long as you like, basically.
Okay, I kind of get this. Probably looking at it after maybe an hour, I'll get it. But now I want your book, Oliver. Yeah.
See, that's why I'm writing a book about it, really. You know, it's a little hard to explain.
Now I get it. Yeah, yeah, it is.
Using
it
only is. Spoken words.
Yeah, okay, so now, all right, so now we get to the third example here. So
yes, so the third example is pretty much exactly the same as the second one, only this time I'm using the lambda expression syntax to do the same thing, right? And I get this interesting chain of elements which just says x goes to, that's the weird little lambda operator thing, right? The equals and greater sign. So x goes to y goes to x plus y. And so what's happening there is pretty much exactly the same thing as in the delegate, only the syntax with the lambda is of course, much shorter. And it's much harder if you see it for the first time to realize, you know, so to speak, the hierarchy of the thing. The thing that's right off the first goes to operator is actually what's being returned. And that is in turn a function itself, right? So just compare to the delegate example, it's exactly the same thing.
So the add C, which is the add curry, is the same thing as the add C2.
That is right.
They're just one's more verbose with the anonymous delegate, and mm-hmm. the other one is just using the lambda. So just for clarification, which one could I use with C# 2.0, and which one could I do in C# 3.0?
You could do the delegate one with C-sharp 2. There's one little problem in there, though, which is that I'm using the funk delegate types. These are delegate types that are part of .NET 3.5, right?
Right,
but
right.
You could, of course, declare your own delegate types, which you basically always had to do before Link came along, and Microsoft thought it would be good to have those generic delegates available. You would have to create your own or define your own funk of T or whatever it is if you were using C-sharp 2. But the syntax of the expression itself with the delegate keyword is the one you could be using in C-sharp 2 as well.
Okay, so now let's go down to the little example where you got the var keywords. You got var at
right.
5. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So roll into that.
So what's happening there is a process called partial application. So application is basically what you do to a function, right? You apply a function to a parameter. Now, the add function, or rather my original add function, had two parameters. So I could only apply the original add function to two parameters at a time. There wasn't a way to just say, I just want one of them, right? But now, since my function chain has functions that each take only one parameter, I'm free to just call the function with one parameter. And as a result, I will get back a new function. And this new function, as I said previously, that's what I like to describe it like. It's basically a slightly more specific version of the original function. So while the add thing was able to add any arbitrary two numbers, my new function is only able to add some fixed number, which in this example is 5, to some other value that I still have to pass in, right? And that is function construction, creating new functions out of existing functions without doing anything like overloading or overriding or whatever approaches you use in imperative object-oriented programming.
Hey, everybody. I wanted to thank our sponsor this episode. It's TechSmith. They make some really cool products. If you've ever tried to do like snapshots and screen captures of your applications or maybe your desktop, you know, sometimes it can be difficult. Well, Snagit does a great job with that. So, I recommend it if you're working with PowerPoint presentations or software documentation or blogs, just about anything that you need to capture areas of your desktop.
That's right. You know, Camtasia Studio just came out with version 6.0, and it's a great product too. The really cool features I like about it, Woody, are they now support QuickTime movies. That is awesome. So now my little HD camera that I have saves stuff as QuickTime. So now I can actually edit my video and produce something and put it up on YouTube. So both of them are great products, folks. If you haven't ever tried them out, please give them a try. They're very involved in the community, and we certainly appreciate them.
So you can find evals and more information on the products at techsmith.com. Could I, on this var add 5, instead of sending in a 5, could you send in a stored value, maybe something out of... Could it access a piece of data that changes, like say currency? So you could say like convert US to euro, and you would have this partial function that was dynamic. So whenever you called it, it would.
No, I think your idea is good. Basically, you could do that, but not with that precise function, because that precise function expects parameters of type int, right? And those are not going to change. So, but you could, of course, have a function, for instance, that takes a function as a parameter, and that might be the conversion function that you're going to use. And then you could use that conversion function with partial application. So, yeah, easy. No worries.
Yeah. I mean, really, that would work.
Yeah, this could work, yeah.
Okay, so going back down to where we have, var add 5 here, add 5 is technically our function. So we're using the var keyword to do type inference, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we have add 5 is now our function, and that's where the whole functional thing is coming from. So this result would give us 42.
That is true.
That
exactly.
Is crazy.
It seems like you've understood it.
Yeah.
I think cool. I get it now.
I am teachable. I am trainable.
Oh, you're clever.
I am trainable. Eventually, everything becomes intuitive after a while. You ever notice that?
Oh, if you know how it works.
You know what? It only takes a couple whacks of the 2x4 to get things in our head. So,
okay. So now that we've got the sort of the basic premise, and again, I hope you guys that are listening to the show pull up the pull up the blog post and just you know, grok it. Now that we've sort of got the basics, what are some really, really cool things we could do now that we've sort of got this fundamental? I mean, what is your brain going to, like, as you're writing the book, like, oh, I could do this, I could do that?
Yes, well, to stay with the example of Turing and partial application, it's basically it allows you to create new functions. Now you say, okay, in my classes I can always create new functions. There's nothing new in that, right? But the difference is that I can create new functions within other functions. So I've got a new level of modularization that I can use, which is very interesting as a maintainability aspect, really, of software engineering. Also, it makes it easier to create new reusable functionality for the purpose of an algorithm, for instance. Just imagine you've got an algorithm that's a little too long, you start refactoring your method and everything, but you don't really want to go outside that method. Now suddenly you can create reusable things within that method to do your work with. And for instance, the link package contains a lot of functions that are very close to things that traditional functional languages also have, like, you know, those select, filter, and where, and so on functions. They relate closely to what I call standard higher order functions in other languages called map, filter, and reduce.
Right.
And you can do a lot of things with those guys if you use partial application, because these functions take other functions as parameters. And if you use that with partial application, then you're actually able to use, for instance, the aggregate function in link and simply make it do summing up as a default, right? Aggregation can do all sorts of things. It can sum up. It could also multiply, or it could just drop everything under the table and return the last element. It's all sure. Aggregation. But basically, you have a chance of specifying the particular aggregation algorithm you want to use using partial application and creating, again, that slightly more specific function out of one that already existed. And you do all this on a functional level as opposed to going up to the class level in order to do it.
Very, very interesting. I'm sitting here thinking, like, okay, what else is in functional stuff? A lot of people say we like to use functional programming because we can, you know, do a lot of parallel stuff, you know, and
yes,
things.
Right.
So what's your story there, you know, with your functional C#?
Yes. Well, that is actually quite independent from the language you use, to be quite honest. Because, I mean, basically, the thing is, if you do parallel programming today, you create threads, right? At least on, you know, Windows you do, on .NET you do. You create threads and things run in parallel, and then you've got all these things stored away that all your threads are going to work with, that is data. And suddenly they clash, because as soon as they start accessing stuff at the same time, certainly as soon as anybody's going to change that data, your threads are going to clash. So you use approaches like locks and semaphores and what have you in order to solve those issues, which is cool if you get it right. But everybody who's tried that knows that it's not hard, not easy to get it right. And even if you do get it right, it's still sort of like a workaround, because basically you want things to run in parallel, and what a lock does is it makes sure that things do not run in parallel, right? So that is not really that does not really solve the problem. That is just a workaround to prevent your application from crashing.
Yeah, it's just a preventive
preventive
measure to stop users from stop the app from crashing.
Exactly. So one of the core ideas behind the whole functional programming approach is that you shouldn't really have, first of all, mutable data, meaning any sort of data that can be changed, and second, data that is external to functions. So, having local variables is cool. Having variables on a different level is not so cool. Now, a lot of people go, why shouldn't I have fields in my classes, for instance, right? Well, you know, I mean, how long ago is it that somebody told you, it's a bad idea to have global variables in your, say, C application or something, right? It's a long time ago. Nobody doubts that. But look at classes. Isn't that exactly the same thing? We've only got a different scope. But in a C application, we had global variables. We had a lot of functions that were sort of accessing, modifying potentially these variables. And that was a bad idea for reasons that everybody knows these days. But in a class, you've got exactly the same situation. You've got fields, and there are several functions or methods in the class that access and potentially change those variables. Same situation, right? So, functional programming offers a way to write applications without resorting to variables that are stored outside the context of a particular method, and without having any immutable data at all in some cases. I mean, some traditional functional languages actually simply didn't have mutable data, so you never had a choice. And it was basically learning to program in a functional way is learning to remove these elements that you don't want from your application and still getting things done. Because that is, of course, the first question that everybody asks. You know, if I don't have any variables, how on earth am I ever going to write any useful application? And functional programming, the whole theory of functional programming sort of answers that question. And that's, of course, if you imagine having that multi-threading parallel situation without any of those locking issues, the world is great, isn't it? And debugging and testing at the same time is great as well. So there are lots of maintainability things there. I mean, think of mock objects. You know mock objects? I suppose so. So why do you have mock objects? Because in object-oriented programming, a lot of the problems you have when unit testing or functional testing stuff is that basically you have to emulate all the environment that surrounds the object you're currently testing. Well, in functional programming, you don't have that sort of problem because you're not supposed to be accessing stuff that goes on outside your own function. A functional function, so to speak, a pure function, as they say, is one that only acts on its input parameters and creates a return value based on that and doesn't go outside the scope. And so you don't need mock objects because mock objects, you know, are an answer to the problem that you have external data. Debugging is great. You know, if you've got that problem with your customer that only ever happens on Friday afternoons when the boss's secretary uses the application. Well, a simple log file will help you find that with if you've got a fully functional approach, because basically if function X creates the wrong result when you pass it parameters A, B, and C, then it's always going to do that. It doesn't just do that in that particular context. It always does that.
Because so. it doesn't have a state.
Yes, because it doesn't have external data of any kind, no state information, nothing, right? So that's basically the idea. And I know that the idea sounds abstract to a lot of people. It is an idea that has a lot of obvious advantages, and it's not easy to realize in C#. It's not easy to realize in the minds of most people who are really used to imperative or object-oriented programming. But even though it's hard, it's worth it because it has so many interesting benefits.
When did you actually come onto this and start really thinking about this? So how did you get from waking up one day and writing C# and this started sort of to click in your brain?
Yeah, well, actually, I've been using functional languages in the past. For instance, I've been writing stuff in Lisp for the Emacs editor, for example,
right,
which was cool. And I've been playing around with Haskell. I haven't actually done anything major in the language, but that's a pure functional language as well. So the approaches were always very interesting to me. And for some reason, someday I thought it would be great to do that in C# as well. And I guess that's probably like 2 years, maybe 3 years ago, something like that.
Now, when is your book going to come out, Oliver?
It's targeted for the middle of next year. I don't have a precise date yet, but that's roughly when it is.
So basically for the next X number of months, your family's just going to miss you, and you're going to be writing and typing, huh?
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. But
Who's the publisher?
It's with Rocks.
Rocks, cool, yeah. You know, it was funny to watch him actually type on the keyboard a while ago because he's used to is it pronounced Dvorak keyboards, I have it? Said?
I think it's Dvorak. I always thought it was Dvorak, but it's not apparently.
So I don't know how to say it. Too big of a word for me in the South to pronounce. But he was. It was really kind of funny to watch him actually type on a standard keyboard.
So I have to ask,
how is this affecting DevExpress? Are you building some of this stuff into your products?
We've considered it. We don't actually have anything like that at the moment, no. But I've considered in the past to write a refactoring to do currying, for example, automatically in CodeRush or in Refactor, rather. We don't have anything in that right now, but it might appear in the future. It's a good idea.
Yeah, it is. Being able to add that stuff in there. So, well, you know, bringing up DevExpress, you know, you guys made some really cool announcements here. You're a platinum sponsor at PDC, which is really cool. And you guys actually had Mini Me over
Mad
at the
Mini
booth.
Me, Vern yeah. Troyer. Yeah.
Yeah, he was over.
He
at
was
the,
here.
He was, and I can't believe how short he really is. And
yep, we couldn't believe it either.
I mean,
it's amazing. Yeah.
It's really amazing to see how short he is. So okay, so let's. You guys made some really cool announcements about what you're doing with your products, and you're sort of giving stuff away, which is kind of cool. So go down that path for us.
Well, the most important announcement, of course, was the DX helmet, right? Well, you guys seen the video yet? You
have not seen the video.
So that's our new, you know, brainwave controlled version, a way of using Visual Studio through Code Rush and Refactor. So you guys should have a look at that. It's on tv.devexpress.com. There's a video of us introducing the DX helmet. So that's amazing. And the other announcement concerned Code Rush Express, which is a new package basically for Code Rush. We've been having several deals with Microsoft in the past where we gave away versions of Refactor for that were specific to VB, for instance, and also for ASP.NET. Now we have this Code Rush Express package, which has some of the functionality of Code Rush, some of the functionality of Refactor. And it's handled by the C# team, but I'm pretty sure it works in all languages. So that's something we haven't had before, really. This is something for everyone in there, and it's free.
Okay, so that's out right now?
That is out right now, yes.
Okay, so for those that don't know what that product does, if they're just in case they're not familiar, I mean, I use it, and we've
I use it
before.
Also.
Yeah, so give us a high level as to what the tool actually does and provides for people.
So basically our professional products, there are two of them. They are Refactor and Code Rush, which are tools for the IDE, for Visual Studio. And Refactor is about refactoring, which is quite a clearly defined process, of course, of changing code for maintainability reasons, readability, sometimes performance even, but without actually changing what the code does, right? So that's refactoring. It's clearly defined. And we've got, I don't know exactly, above 150, I believe, at this point in there. And Code Rush is more like a catch-all solution for a variety of different other productivity tools for developers, which includes a templating engine and a number of things that you can do with selections, and it includes our new code issues in the next release, at least they are in. We've got a pre-release version of that one in the current version of Code Rush as well, where basically the product looks at your code and finds things that might be problematic, like, you know, there's a piece of unused code, or you're using too many namespace references, or hundreds of other things, really. So these are the two products. And Code Rush Express basically combines some of the features from Code Rush and some of those from Refactor. But, you know, we've had that thing, as I said, with Refactor in the past, and it's not just meant to be a marketing vehicle or anything like that. It's really a product that has lots of useful functionalities and provides a productivity gain for those who don't want to buy the full versions, really.
So does that work with Visual Studio 2008 and 05, or just
yes,
with 2008?
It works with 2008, 2005, and all the languages are supported. So we're currently working on 2010. That'll be available a little later, I guess.
Right. Going to the on the Code Rush Express stuff. So, are you guys still keeping a pay for version? I would assume.
Yes.
Yeah. Right?
Yes, we will.
So, what's the major difference or bang for the buck? So what do I get for one versus the other?
Right. So on the refactor front, it's quite simple. You get loads of additional refactorings. I don't know the precise number. Well, the free refactor versions we had used to have something like 30 refactorings, I think. And I think the Code Rush Express is going to have a similar number, which are very, very useful. But the professional version has an ever-increasing number of refactorings that is beyond 150 right now, I think. So on the Code Rush front, the one of the most interesting pieces of functionality, I think, that is not in Code Rush Express is the templating engine. So the way you can create code very quickly by using shortcuts for certain constructs and so on, that is not available in the Express edition. So it's a lot about, you know, using more efficient keyboard navigation, using those selection features that we have, and a bunch of other things. But the templating engine, for instance, is missing.
So one of the things that I didn't ever get, is this going to ship in the next version of VS 2010? Like, is it going to be baked in, or is it always going to be just a download for free?
That's a very good question. I can't answer.
Okay.
I don't know really what the deal is. I don't know if that detail is even decided at this point, because obviously VS 2010 isn't really shipping yet.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. Either way, I think. I don't know.
All right. So what's your favorite deep fried food?
I guess chicken.
Chicken. Everybody loves chicken.
Everybody loves chicken.
You ever had a fried Snickers?
What's wrong with chicken? I have actually had a fried Mars bar.
Mars bar.
You know, you might not know, but Scottish people deep fry a lot. So, you know, they deep fry Mars bars, for instance, and a whole bunch of other crazy things.
Somebody in the audience just said pizza. You guys deep fried pizza?
Deep fried pizza, yeah.
I actually like deep fried. My favorite deep fried thing is deep fried banana peppers.
Banana peppers?
Banana, you know, the long yellow.
Oh, no, I see.
I like jalapeno peppers.
Yeah, they're good, too, but I like the banana peppers because they're sweeter.
Well, I do like deep fried bananas.
Yeah, those are good. And you dip it in chocolate. I mean, bananas are kind of like the all wonderful.
Okay, you guys are making me hungry now.
We haven't had lunch, and we're actually running late. Just before we close out, Oliver, what's the coolest thing that you think is going to change the world that you've seen at PDC so far?
Of course, the DX helmet. Nah, I'm joking.
You love the DX helmet.
Well, that's exactly how we announced it, right? It's going to change the world and everything. What's the coolest thing? I don't know. There's a lot of interesting stuff around. You know, it's this Microsoft Azure is the name, right? Looks really cool. Whether it's going to change the world, I'm not sure. It's, you know, something that other vendors already have on other platforms and so on. So maybe that's not going to change the world. I think Visual Studio 2010 is going to change the world. I'm sure of that.
Yeah, I do too. With the new, with all the new language features that are coming out across all the languages and across all the DSLs and Iron Python, Iron Ruby, F Sharp. So I mean, it's going to be amazing what the future is.
They announced that Visual Studio 2010 is going to be all baked in WPF now.
Oh yeah,
right.
Right.
How does that affect like a vendor like yourself? Are you guys having to go back and retool everything?
No, luckily not, because a lot of the integration APIs are not changing too much. But we'll obviously have to do a lot of work because we've got all that visualization functionality, you know, stuff that runs on the editor surface and displays graphical things on there. And we'll have to do a lot of work in that regard. But, of course, WPF also opens a lot of new possibilities for us in that way. So, yeah, some of that stuff is already in the works, as I hear.
Yeah, so that probably keeps our good buddy, Mr. Mark Miller, busy.
Busy,
he's probably losing sleep right now. So,
yeah, I think he actually is, since I believe he's preparing something to be shown at Tech at Europe.
Yeah.
I'm going to be there, and if you are too, maybe you're going to see it. I don't know.
Well, we might have some listeners there. So
for the future.
Yeah,
for
so that's
out
some
there,
free
so.
Future
when
stuff.
When is Tech
so.
At Europe?
In 2 weeks' time.
It's going to be really close then, huh?
It is really close.
So
then,
we should keep our eyes peeled. There may be something coming out. A little more mini-me or...
No, well, this is about 2010, right?
Sure.
So, but we might be showing some stuff.
Cool. I mean, we actually watched, you know, Guthrie do a keynote, and he did... He basically just replaced the whole commenting, you know, system with a plug-in and showed the extensibility. I can't imagine what... Some of you guys are going to go to town
with all the good people at DevExpress.
Oh,
I'm
yeah,
sure there'll
be
some great, stuff coming out. So Oliver, what's your blog? Because I know our listeners, after seeing all this stuff, they'll want to keep up with what you're coming out with.
Yeah, my blog is at sturmnet.org. That's sturmnet.org with an M in the middle, as in mother, right? Because everybody always gets that one wrong.
Right.
I should get an easier blog, I think. You know, like oliveriscool.com. Or, no, that sucks. Okay.
We already know that one, so that's obvious. So.
Right. So that's where it is. And I blog sort of irregularly depending on, you know, the schedule that I have. But there's a lot of interesting stuff on there, I think, including my fantastic instant gratification for developers plugin that I'm just going to plug in here.
Yeah, yeah. We'll bring a I'll put a link into the show notes for that. So that's very cool. So people can take a look at that.
All right. Well, let's close it up. Oliver, I really appreciate it. I think a lot of people are going to really get a lot of great value out of this with functional programming and C#, folks. You heard it first here on Deep Fried Bytes.
And also go out and get the new Code Rush Express. So it is very cool. I've taken a look at it.
Yeah, go out and download that. So Oliver, appreciate you coming on. It's always a pleasure to see you at all the conferences. We always see you around. It's always a pleasure to hang out with you. And Mr. Woody enjoyed hanging out with you as well. Let's go get something to eat.
Let's go get some food. Maybe they have some deep fried stuff.
That's what they do. Thanks for tuning in, folks. There's another episode of Deep Fried Bites. As always, you can reach us at comments at deepfriedbites.com. We'd love to get your feedback. We'll put up Oliver's stuff. You can catch him as well. This is it, folks. We're going to go get some food, and Deep Fried Bites is out. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.